support from their parent agency. Chet Nomori nodded. That leaves you, sir. That's right. And if you lose us, you return to your cover and you don't do anything. Got that? Nothing at all. You're a loyal Japanese citizen and you stay in your hole. But nothing, kid. You are under my orders now, and if you violate them, you answer to me. Clark softened his voice. Your first priority is always survival. We don't issue suicide pills, and we don't expect movie-type bullshit. A dead officer is a dumb officer. Damn, Clark thought. Had the mission been different from the very beginning, they would have had a routine established. Dead drops, a whole collection of signals, a selection of cutouts. But there wasn't time to do that now, and every second they talked here in the shadows, there was the chance that some Tokyoite would let his cat out, see a Japanese national talking to a gaijin and make note of it. The paranoia curve had risen fast and would only get steeper. Okay, you say so, man. And don't forget it. Stick to your regular routine. Don't change anything, except maybe to back off some. Fit in. Act like everybody else does. A nail that sticks up gets hammered down. Hammer's hurt, boy. Now, here's what I want you to do. Clark went on for a minute. Got it? Yes, sir. Get lost. Clark headed down the alley and entered his hotel through the delivery entrance, thankfully unwatched at this time of night. Thank God, he thought, that Tokyo had so little crime. The American equivalent would be locked or have an alarm or be patrolled by an armed guard. Even at war, Tokyo was a safer place than Washington, D.C. Why don't you just buy a bottle instead of going out to drink? Chekhov asked, not for the first time when he came back into the room. Maybe I should, which reply made the younger officer's eyes jerk up from his paper and his Russian practice. Clark pointed to the TV, turned it on, and found CNN headline news in English. Now for my next trick. How the hell do I get the word in? He wondered. He didn't dare use the fax machine to America. Even the Washington Interfax office was far too grave a risk. The one in Moscow didn't have the encryption gear needed, and he couldn't go through the embassy's CIA connection either. There was one set of rules for operating in a friendly country and another for a hostile one, and nobody had expected the rules that made the rules to change without warning. That he and other CIA officers should have provided forewarning of the event was just one more thing to anger the experienced spy. The congressional hearings on that one were sure to be entertaining if he lived long enough to enjoy them. The only good news was that he had the name of a probable suspect in the murder of Kimberly Norton. That, at least, gave him something to fantasize about. And his mind had little other useful activity to undertake at the moment. At the half hour, it was clear that even CNN didn't know what was going on, and if CNN didn't know, then nobody did. Wasn't that just great, Clark thought. It was like the legend of Cassandra, the daughter of King Priam of Troy, who always knew what was happening and who was always ignored. But Clark didn't even have a way of getting the word out. Did he? I wonder if... No, he shook his head. That was too crazy. All ahead full, the commanding officer of Eisenhower said. All ahead full aye, the quartermaster on the annunciator pushed the handles forward. A moment later, the inner arrow rotated to the same position. Sir, engine room answers all ahead full. Very well. The CO looked over at Admiral Dubrow. Care to lay any bets, sir? The best information, oddly enough, came from sonar. Two of the battlegroup's escorts had their towed array sonars called tails streamed, and their data, combined with that of two nuclear submarines to the formation starboard, indicated that the Indian formation was a good way off to the south. It was one of those odd instances, more common than one might expect, where sonar far outperformed radar, whose electronic waves were limited by the curve of the earth, while sound waves found their own deep channels. The Indian fleet was over 150 miles away, and though that was spitting distance for jet attack aircraft, the Indians were looking to their south, not the north, and it further appeared that Admiral Chandrasekhar didn't relish night flight operations and the risks they entailed for his limited collection of Harriers. Well, both men thought, night landings on a carrier weren't exactly fun. Better than even, Admiral Dubrow replied after a moment's analysis. I think you're right. The formation was blacked out, not an unusual circumstance for warships. All its radars turned off, and the only radios in use were line-of-sight units with burst transmission capability, which broadcast for hundredths of seconds only. Even satellite sets generated side lobes that could betray their position, and their covert passage south of Sri Lanka was essential. World War II was like this, the CO went, giving voice to his nerves. They were depending on the most human of fundamentals. Extra lookouts had been posted who used both regular binoculars and night-eye electronic devices to sweep the horizon for silhouettes and mast tops, while others on lower decks looked closer in for the telltale feather of a submarine periscope. The Indians had two submarines out on which Dubrow did not have even an approximate location. They were probably probing south, too. But if Chandrasekhar was really as smart as he feared, he would have left one close in, just as insurance. Maybe. Dubrow's deception operation had been a skillful one. Admiral, Dubrow's head turned. It was a signalman. Flash traffic from sync pack. The petty officer handed over the clipboard and held a red-covered flashlight over the dispatch so that the battlegroup commander could read it. Did you acknowledge receipt? The admiral asked before he started reading. No, sir, you left orders to chimp everything down. Very good, sailor. Dubrow started reading. In a second, he was holding both the clipboard and the flashlight. Son of a bitch! Special Agent Robertson would drive Kathy home, and with that notification, Ryan again became a government functionary, rather than a human being with a wife and family. It was a short walk to Marine One, its rotor already turning. President and Mrs. Durling, Jumper and Jasmine, had done the requisite smiles for the cameras, and had used the opportunity of the long flight to beg off answering any questions. Ryan trailed behind like some sort of equerry. "Take an hour to get caught up," Durling said as the helicopter landed on the south lawn of the White House. "When is the ambassador scheduled in?" 11:30, Brett Hansen replied. "I want you, Arnie, and Jack there for the meeting." "Yes, Mr. President," the Secretary of State acknowledged. The usual photographers were there, but most of the White House reporters, who shouted questions so annoyed everyone, were still back at Andrews collecting their bags. Inside the ground floor entrance was a larger contingent of Secret Service agents than normal. Ryan headed west and was in his office 2 minutes later, shedding his coat and sitting down at a desk already decorated with call slips. Those he ignored for the moment as he lifted the phone and dialed CIA. "DDO, welcome back, Jack," Mary Pat Foley said. Ryan didn't bother asking how she knew it was him. Not that many had her direct line. "How bad?" "Our embassy personnel are safe. The embassy has not as yet been entered, and we're destroying everything. Station Tokyo, as all CIA stations had become in the last 10 years, was completely electronic now. Destroying files was a question of seconds and left no telltale smoke. Ought to be done by now." The procedure was straightforward. The various computer disks were erased, reformatted, erased again, then subjected to powerful handheld magnets. The bad news was that some of the data was irreplaceable, though not so much so as the people who generated it. There was now a total of 3 illegals in Tokyo, the net human intelligence assets of the United States in what was probably an enemy country.
What else?
They're letting people travel back and forth to their homes with escort. Actually, they're playing it pretty cool, Mrs. Foley said, her surprise not showing. It's not like Tehran in 79, anyway. For communications, they're letting us use satellite links so far, but those are being electronically monitored. The embassy has 1 STU-6 operating, the rest have been deactivated. We still have tap dance capability, too, she finished, mentioning the random pad cipher that all embassies now used through the National Security Agency's communications net. Other assets, Ryan asked, hoping that his own secure line was not compromised, but using cover procedure even so. Without the legals, they're pretty much cut off. The worry in her voice was clear with that answer, along with quite a bit of self-reproach. The agency still had operations in quite a few countries that did not absolutely require embassy personnel as part of the loop, but Japan wasn't one of them, and even Mary Pat couldn't make hindsight retroactive.
Do they even know what's going on?
It was an astute question, the deputy director operations thought, and another needle in her flesh.
Unknown, Mrs. Foley admitted. They didn't get any word to us. They either do not know or have been compromised, which was a nicer way of saying arrested.
Other stations.
Jack, we got caught with our knickers down, and that's a fact.
For all the grief that it had to cause her, Ryan heard, she was reporting facts like a surgeon in the O.R. What a shame that Congress would grill her unmercifully for the intelligence lapse.
I have people in Seoul and Beijing shaking the bushes, but I don't expect anything back from them for hours.
Ryan was rummaging through his pink call sheets.
I have one here, an hour old, from Golovko.
Hell, call the bastard, Mary Pat said at once. Let me know what he says.
Will do.
Jack shook his head, remembering what the two men had talked about.
Get down here fast. Bring Ed. I need a gut call on something, but not over the phone.
Be there in 30, Mrs. Foley said.
Jack spread out several faxes on his desk and scanned them quickly. The Pentagon's operations people had been faster than the other agencies, but now DIA was checking in, quickly followed by State.
The government was awake. Nothing like gunfire to accomplish that, Jack thought wryly. But the data was mainly repetitive, different agencies learning the same thing at different times and reporting in as though it were new. He flipped through the call sheets again, and clearly the majority of them would say the same thing. His eyes came back to the one from the chairman of the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service. Jack lifted the phone and made the call, wondering which of the phones on Golovko's desk would ring. He took out a scratch pad, noting the time. The signals office would take note of the call, of course, and tape it, but he wanted to keep his own notes.
Hello, Jack. Your private line, Sergei Nikolaevich? For an old friend, why not?
The Russian paused, ending the joviality for the day.
I presume you know.
Oh, yeah. Ryan thought for a moment before going on.
We were caught by surprise, he admitted.
Jack heard a very Russian grunt of sympathy.
So were we.
Completely.
Do you have any idea what the madmen are up to?
The RVS chairman asked, his voice a mixture of anger and concern.
No, I see nothing at the moment that makes any sense at all, and perhaps that was the most worrying part of all.
What plans do you have?
Right now, none, Ryan said. Their ambassador is due here in less than an hour.
Splendid timing on his part, the Russian commented.
They've done this to you before, if memory serves.
And to you, Ryan said, remembering how the Russo-Japanese War had begun.
They do like their surprises.
Yes, Ryan, and to us.
And that, Jack knew, was why Sergei had made the call and why his voice showed genuine concern. Fear of the unknown wasn't limited to children after all, was it?
Can you tell me what sort of assets you have in place to deal with the crisis?
I'm not sure at the moment, Sergei, Ryan lied.
If your Washington residentura is up to speed, you know I just got in. I need time to get caught up. Mary Pat is on her way down to my office now.
Ah, Jack heard over the line.
Well, it was an obvious lie, he'd told, and Sergei was a wise old pro, wise enough to know.
You were very foolish not to have activated Thistle sooner, my friend.
This is an open line, Sergei Nikolaevich, which was partially true. The phone call was routed through the American Embassy in Moscow on a secure circuit, but from there on it was a standard commercial line, probably, and therefore subject to possible bugging.
You need not be overly concerned, Ivan Nemedovich. Do you recall our conversation in my office?
Oh, yeah. Maybe the Russians really did have the Japanese counterintelligence chief under their control. If so, he was in a position to know if the phone call was secure or not, and if so, there were some other cards in his hand, nice ones. Was he offering Ryan a peek?
Think fast, Jack, Ryan commanded himself. Okay, the Russians have another network up and running.
Sergei, this is important. You did not have any warning?
Jack, on my honor as a spy? Ryan could almost hear the twisted smile that must be framing the answer.
I just had to tell my president that I was caught with my fly unbuttoned, and the embarrassment to me is even greater than what...
Jack didn't bother listening to the embroidery. Okay, the Russians did have another spy network operating in Japan, but they'd probably not received any warning either, had they?
No, the danger from that sort of double-dealing was just too great.
Next fact. Their second network was inside the Japanese government itself. Had to be, if they had PSID penetrated. But Thistle was mainly a commercial spy net, always had been, and Sergei had just told him that the U.S. had been foolish not to have activated it sooner. The novelty of what he knew distracted Jack from a more subtle implication surrounding the admission of fault from Moscow.
Sergei Nikolaevich, I'm short of time here. You are building to something. What is it?
I propose cooperation between us. I have the approval of President Grushavoy to make the offer.
He didn't say full cooperation, Jack noted, but the offer was startling even so.
Never, not ever, not once, except in bad movies, had KGB and CIA really cooperated on anything important. Sure, the world had changed plenty, but KGB, even in its new incarnation, still worked to penetrate American institutions and remained good at it. That was why you didn't let them in. But he just made the offer anyway.
Why?
The Russians are scared.
Of what?
I will present that to my president after consulting with Mary Pat.
Ryan wasn't yet sure how he would present it.
Golovko, however, knew the value of what he'd just laid on the American's desk. It would not require much insight to speculate on the probable reply.
Again, Ryan could hear the smile.
If Folieva does not agree, I will be most surprised. I will be in my office for a few more hours.
So will I. Thanks, Sergei.
Good day, Dr. Ryan.
Well, that sounded interesting, Robbie Jackson said in the doorway. Looks like you had a long night, too.
In an airplane yet.
Coffee? Jack asked.
The Admiral shook his head. One more cup and I might shake apart. He came in and sat down.
Bad, and getting worse.
We're still trying to tally how many uniformed people we have in Japan. There are some transients. An hour ago, a C-141 landed at Yokota and promptly went off the air.
The goddamn thing just headed right in, Robbie said.
Maybe a radio problem. More likely, they didn't have the gas to go anywhere else. Flight crew of four, maybe five, I forget. State is trying to run a tally for how many businessmen are there in order to generate an approximate number, but there are tourists to consider also.
Hostages, Ryan frowned.
The Admiral nodded.
Figure the 10,000 is a floor figure.
The two subs?
Jackson shook his head.
Dead, no survivors. Stennis has recovered her airplane and is heading for Pearl at about 12 knots.
Enterprise is trying to make turns on one shaft and is under tow. She's making maybe six.
Maybe none if the engine damage is as bad as the CO told us.
They've sent a big salvage tug to help with that. We've sent some P-3s to Midway to do anti-submarine patrols.
If I were on the other side, I'd try to finish them off.
Johnny Reb ought to be okay, but Big E's a hell of a ripe target. Sinkpack is worried about that.
We're out of the power projection business, Jack.
Guam. All the Marianas are off the air except for one thing, Jackson explained about Areza.
All he tells us is how bad things are.
Recommendations.
I have people looking at some ideas, but for starters, we need to know if the president wants us to try.
Will he? Robbie asked.
Their ambassador will be here soon.
Good of him.
You didn't answer my question, Dr. Ryan.
I don't know the answer yet.
There's a confidence builder. For Captain Bud Sanchez, the experience was unique. It was not quite a miracle that he'd recovered the S-3 Viking without incident. The Hoover was a docile aircraft floating in, and there'd been a whole 20 knots of wind over the deck. Now his entire air wing was back aboard, and his aircraft carrier was running away. Running away, not heading into harm's way, the creed of the United States Navy, but limping back to Pearl. The five squadrons of fighters and attack aircraft on the deck of John Stennis just sat there, lined up in neat rows on the flight deck, all ready for combat operations, but except in a really dire emergency, unable to take off. It was a question of wind and weight. Carriers turned into the wind to launch and recover aircraft and needed the most powerful engines placed aboard ships to give the greatest possible airflow over the bow. The moving air added to the takeoff impulse generated by the steam catapults to give lift to the aircraft flung into the air. Their ability to take off was directly governed by that airflow, and more significantly, from a tactical point of view, the magnitude of the airflow governed the weight they could carry aloft, which meant fuel and weapons. As it was, he could get airplanes off, but without the gas needed to stay aloft long or to hunt across the oceans for targets, and without the weapons needed to engage those targets. He judged that he had the ability to use fighters to defend the fleet against an air threat out to a radius of perhaps 100 miles, but there was no air threat, and though they knew the position of the retiring Japanese formations, he did not have the ability to reach them with his attack birds. But then he didn't have orders to allow him to do it anyway. Night at sea is supposed to be a beautiful thing, but it was not so this time. The stars and gibbous moon reflected off the calm surface of the ocean, making everyone nervous. There was easily enough light to spot the ships, blackout or not. The only really active aircraft of his wing were the anti-submarine helicopters, whose blinking anti-collision lights sparkled mainly forward of the carriers, aided also by those of some of Johnny Reb's escorts. The only good news was that the slow fleet speed made for excellent performance by the sonar systems on the destroyers and frigates, whose large aperture arrays were streamed out in their wakes. Not too many. The majority of the escorts had lingered behind with Enterprise circling her in two layers, like bodyguards for a chief of state, while one of their number, an Aegis cruiser, tried to help her along with a towing wire, increasing her speed of advance to a whole 6.5 knots at the moment. Without a good storm over the bow, Big E could not conduct flight operations at all. Submarines, historically the greatest threat to carriers, might be out there. Pearl Harbor said they had no contacts at all in the vicinity of the now-divided battle force, but that was an easy thing to say from a shore base. The sonar operators, urged by nervous officers to miss nothing, were instead finding things that weren't there. Eddies in the water, echoes of conversing fish, whatever. The nervous state of the formation was manifested by the way a frigate 5 miles out increased speed and turned sharply left, her sonar undoubtedly pinging away now, probably at nothing more than the excited imagination of a sonarman third class who might or might not have heard a whale fart. Maybe two farts, Captain Sanchez thought. One of his own Seahawks was hovering low over the surface, dipping her sonar dome to do her own sniffing. 1,300 miles back to Pearl Harbor, Sanchez thought. 12 knots. That came to 4.5 days, every mile of it under the threat of submarine attack. The other question was what genius had thought that pulling back from the Western Pacific had been a good idea. Was the United States a global power or not? Projecting power around the world was important, wasn't it? Certainly it had been, Sanchez thought, remembering his classes at the War College. Newport had been his last tour prior to undertaking the position of Commander Air Wing. The U.S. Navy had been the balance of power over the entire world for two generations, able to intimidate merely by existing, merely by letting people see the pictures in their updated copies of Jane's fighting ships. You could never know where those ships were. You could only count the empty berths in the great naval bases and wonder. Well, there wouldn't be much wondering now.
The two biggest graving docks at Pearl Harbor would be full for some time to come, and if the news of the Marianas was correct, America lacked the mobile firepower to take them back, even if Mike Dubrow decided to act like 7th Cavalry and race back home. "Hello, Chris. Thank you for coming." The ambassador would arrive at the White House in only a few minutes. The timing was impossible, but whoever in Tokyo was making decisions had not troubled himself with Nagumo's convenience, the embassy official knew. It was awkward for another reason as well. Ordinarily, a city that took little note of foreigners, Washington would soon change, and now, for the first time, Nagumo was Gaijin.
"Seiichi, what the hell happened out there?" Cook asked.
Both men belonged to the University Club, a plush establishment located next door to the Russian embassy, and boasting one of the best gyms in town, a favorite place for a good workout and a quick meal. A Japanese commercial business kept a suite of rooms there, and though they would not be able to use this rendezvous again, for the moment it did guarantee anonymity.
"What have they told you, Chris?"
"That one of your Navy ships had a little accident." "Jesus, Seiji, aren't things bad enough without that sort of mistake? Weren't the goddamn gas tanks bad enough?"
Nagumo took a second before responding. In a way, it was good news. The overall events were being kept somewhat secret, as he'd predicted, and the ambassador had hoped. He was nervous now, though his demeanor didn't show it.
"Chris, it was not an accident.
What do you mean?"
"I mean there was a battle of sorts. I mean that my country feels itself to be very threatened and that we have taken certain defensive measures to protect ourselves."
Cook just didn't get it. Though he was part of the State Department's Japan specialists, he had not yet been called in for a full briefing and knew only what he'd caught on his car radio, which was thin enough. It was beyond Chris's imagination, Nagumo saw, to consider that his country could be attacked. After all, the Soviets were gone, weren't they? It was gratifying to Seiji Nagumo. Though appalled at the risks that his country was running and ignorant of the reasons for them, he was a patriot. He loved his country as much as any man. He was also part of its culture. He had orders and instructions. Within the confines of his own mind, he could rage at them, but he decided simply that he was a soldier of his country, and that was that. And Cook was the real Gaijin, not himself. He kept repeating it to himself.
"Chris, our countries are at war after a fashion. You pushed us too far. Forgive me, I am not pleased by this. You must understand that."
"Wait a minute." Chris Cook shook his head as his face twisted into a very quizzical expression.
"You mean war? Real war?"
Nagumo nodded slowly and spoke in a reasonable, regretful tone.
"We have occupied the Mariana Islands. Fortunately, this was accomplished without loss of life. The brief encounter between our two navies may have been more serious, but not greatly so. Both sides are now withdrawing away from one another, which is a good thing."
"You've killed our people?"
"Yes, I regret to say. Some people may have lost their lives on both sides."
Nagumo paused and looked down as though unable to meet his friend's eyes. He'd already seen there the emotions he'd expected.
"Please don't blame me for this, Chris," he went on, quietly, in a voice clearly under very tight control. "But these things have happened. I had no part in it. Nobody asked me for an opinion. You know what I would have said. You know what I would have counseled." Every word was true, and Cook knew it.
"Christ, Seiji, what can we do?"
The question was a manifestation of his friendship and support, and as such very predictable. Also predictably, it gave Nagumo the opening he'd expected and needed.
"We have to find a way to keep things under control. I do not want my country destroyed again. We have to stop this and stop it quickly," which was his country's objective and therefore his own.
"There is no room in the world for this abomination. There are cooler heads in my country. Koto is a fool."
"There," Nagumo threw up his hands. "I have said it. He is a fool. Do we allow our countries to do permanent damage to one another because of fools?
What of your Congress? What of that Trent maniac with his Trade Reform Act? Look what his reforms have brought us to. He was really into it now, able to veil his inner feelings like most diplomats. He was now discovering acting talents made all the more effective by the fact that he really believed in what he was saying. He looked up with tears in his eyes.
Chris, if people like us don't get this thing under control,
my God, then what?
The work of generations, gone. Your country and mine both badly hurt. People dead, progress thrown away. And for what?
Because fools in my country and yours could not work out difficulties on trade.
Christopher, you must help me stop this. You must.
Mercenary and traitor or not, Christopher Cook was a diplomat, and his professional creed was to eliminate war. He had to respond, and he did.
But what can you really do,
Chris?
You know that my position is really more senior than my post would indicate,
Nagumo pointed out.
How else could I have done the things for you to make our friendship what it is?
Cook nodded. He'd suspected as much.
I have friends and influence in Tokyo. I need time. I need negotiating space. With those things I can soften our position, give Goto's political opponents something to work with. We have to put that man in the asylum he belongs in, or shoot him yourself. That maniac might destroy my country.
Chris, for God's sake, you must help me stop him.
The last statement was an entreaty from the heart.
What the hell can I do, Seiji? I'm just a Das, remember? A little Indian. And there's a bunch of chiefs.
You are one of the few people in your State Department who really understand us. They will seek your counsel.
A little flattery. Cook nodded.
Probably if they're smart, he added. Scott Adler knows me. We talk.
If you can tell me what your State Department wants, I can get that information to Tokyo. With luck, I can have my people inside the Foreign Ministry propose it first. If we can accomplish that much, then your ideas will appear to be our ideas, and we can more easily accommodate your wishes.
It was called judo, the gentle art, and consisted mainly of using an enemy's strength and movements against himself. Nagumo thought he was making a very skillful use of it now. It had to appeal to Cook's vanity that he might be able to manage foreign policy himself through cleverness. It appealed to Nagumo's that he'd thought up this gambit.
Cook's face twisted into disbelief again.
But if we're at war, how the hell will...
Goto is not completely mad. We will keep the embassies open as a line of communication. We will offer you a return of the Marianas. I doubt the offer will be completely genuine, but it will be placed on the table as a sign of good faith.
There, Seiji said. I have now betrayed my country.
As planned.
What will be acceptable to your government as an endgame scenario?
In my opinion,
full independence for the Northern Marianas, an end to their Commonwealth status. For reasons of geography and economics, they will fall into our sphere of influence in any case.
I think it is a fair compromise. We do own most of the land there, Nagumo reminded his guest.
That is a guess on my part, but a good one.
What about Guam?
As long as it is demilitarized, it remains U.S. territory. Again, a guess, but a good one.
Time will be necessary for a full resolution of the various issues, but I think we can stop this war before it goes further.
What if we do not agree?
Then many people will die.
We are diplomats, Chris. It is our mission in life to prevent that.
One more time.
If you can help me just to let us know what you want us to do so that I can get our side moving in that direction, you and I can end a war, Chris.
Please,
can you help me?
I won't take any money for this, A.G., Cook said by way of a reply.
Amazing. The man had principles after all.
So much the better that they were not accompanied by insight.
The Japanese ambassador arrived as instructed at the east wing entrance.
A White House usher opened the door on the stretch Lexus, and the Marine at the door saluted, not having been told not to. He walked in alone, unaccompanied by a bodyguard, and he passed through the metal detectors without incident, then turned west, past a long corridor, including, among other things, the entrance to the President's own movie theater. There were portraits of other presidents, sculptures by Frederick Remington, and other reminders of America's frontier history. The walk itself was intended to give the man a sense of the size of the country to which he represented his own. A trio of Secret Service agents escorted him up to the state floor of the building, an area he knew well, then farther west to the wing from which the United States was administered. The looks he saw were not unfriendly, merely correct, but that was quite different from the cordiality he ordinarily received in this building. As a final touch, the meeting was held in the Roosevelt Room. It held the Nobel Prize won by Theodore Roosevelt for negotiating the end of the Russo-Japanese War. If the mode of arrival was supposed to overawe him, the ambassador thought, then the final act was counterproductive. The Americans and others were known for such foolish theatrics. The Indian Treaty Room in the adjacent old executive office building had been designed to overawe savages. This one reminded him of his country's first major conflict, which had raised Japan to the ranks of the great nations by the defeat of another member of that club, Tsarist Russia, a country far less great than she had appeared, internally corrupt, strewn with dissension, given to posturing and bluster. Much like America, in fact, the ambassador thought. He needed such ideas right now to keep his knees from trembling. President Durling was standing and took his hand.
"Mr. Ambassador, you know everyone here. Please be seated."
"Thank you, Mr. President, and thank you for receiving me on such short and urgent notice." He looked around the conference table as Durling went to his seat at the opposite end, nodding to each of them. Brett Hansen, Secretary of State, Arnold Van Damme, the Chief of Staff, John Ryan, the National Security Advisor. The Secretary of Defense was also in the building, he knew, but not here. How interesting. The ambassador had served many years in Washington and knew much of Americans. There was anger in the faces of the men seated, though the president controlled his emotions admirably, just like the security people who stood at the doors. His look was that of a soldier. Hansen's anger was outrage. He could not believe that anyone would be so foolish as to threaten his country in any way. He was like a spoiled child, resenting a failing grade on an exam from a fair and scrupulous teacher. Van Damme was a politician and regarded him as a gaijin, a curious little man. Ryan showed the least anger of all, though it was there, indicated more in the way he held his pen than in the fixed stare of his blue cat's eyes. The ambassador had never dealt with Ryan beyond a few chance encounters at state functions. The same was true of most of the embassy's staff, and though his background was well known to all Washington insiders, Ryan was known to be a European specialist, and therefore ignorant of Japan. That was good, the ambassador thought. Were he more knowledgeable, he might be a dangerous enemy.
"Mr. Ambassador, you requested this meeting," Hansen said. "We will let you begin."
Ryan endured the opening statement. It was lengthy and prepared and predictable, what any country would say under these circumstances, added to which was a little national spice. It wasn't their fault. They'd been pushed, treated as lowly vassals despite years of faithful and productive friendship. They, too, regretted the situation, and so forth. It was just diplomatic embroidery, and Jack let his eyes do the work while his ears filtered out the noise. Most interesting was the demeanor of the speaker. Diplomats in friendly circumstances tended to be florid, and in hostile they droned as though embarrassed to speak their words. Not this time. The Japanese ambassador showed overt strength that spoke of pride in his country and her actions. Not quite defiant, but not embarrassed either. Even the German ambassador, who'd given word of Hitler's invasion to Molotov, had shown grief, Jack remembered. For his part, the president listened impassively, letting Arnie show the anger and Hansen show the shock, Jack saw. Good for him. Mr. Ambassador, war with the United States of America is not a trivial thing, the Secretary of State said when the opening statement was concluded. The ambassador didn't flinch.
It is only a war if you wish it to be. We do not have the desire to destroy your country, but we do have our own security interests.
He went on to state his country's position on the Marianas. They'd been Japanese territory before, and now they were again. His country had a right to its own defensive perimeter, and that, he said, was that.
You do know, Hansen said, that we have the ability to destroy your country.
A nod.
Yes, I do. We well remember your use of nuclear weapons on our country.
Jack's eyes opened a little wider at that answer. On his pad, he wrote, Nukes?
You have something else to say? Durling observed, entering the conversation.
Mr. President, my country also has nuclear arms.
Delivered how? Arnie asked with a snort.
Ryan blessed him silently for the question. There were times when an ass had his place.
My country has a number of nuclear-tipped intercontinental missiles. Your own people have seen the assembly plant. You can check with NASA if you wish.
The ambassador read off the name and the dates in a very matter-of-fact way, noting that Ryan took them down like a good functionary. The room became so quiet that he could hear the scratching of the man's pen. More interesting still were the looks on the other faces.
"Do you threaten us?" Durling asked quietly.
The ambassador looked straight into the man's eyes 20 feet away.
"No, Mr. President, I do not. I merely state a fact. I say again, this is a war only if you wish it so."
Yes, we know you can destroy us if you wish, and we cannot destroy you, though we can cause you great harm.
Over what, Mr. President?
A few small islands that are historically our possessions anyway. They have been Japanese in all but name for years now.
And the people you killed? Van Damme asked.
I regret that sincerely. We will, of course, offer compensation to the families. It is our hope that we can conclude matters. We will not disturb your embassy or its personnel, and we hope that you will grant us the same courtesy to maintain communications between our governments.
Is it so hard, he asked, to think of us as equals? Why did you feel the need to hurt us?
There was a time when a single airplane crash due to a mistake made by your people at Boeing killed more of my citizens than the number of American lives lost in the Pacific. Did we scream at you? Did we threaten your economic security, your very national survival?
No, we did not.
The time has come for my country to take a place in the world. You've withdrawn from the Western Pacific. We must now look to our own defenses. To do that, we need what we need. How can we be sure that having crippled our nation in economic terms, you will not at some later time seek to destroy us physically?
We would never do that, Hansen objected.
Easily, Mr. Secretary. You did it once before, and as you yourself just pointed out, you retain that ability.
We didn't start that war, Van Damme pointed out.
You did not? The ambassador asked.
By cutting off our oil and trade, you faced us with ruin and a war resulted. Just last month you threw our economy into chaos, and you expected us to do nothing, because we had not the ability to defend ourselves.
Well, we do have that ability, the ambassador said.
Perhaps now we can treat as equals.
So far as my government is concerned, the conflict is over. We will take no further action against Americans. Your citizens are welcome in my country. We will amend our trade practices to accommodate your laws. This entire incident could be presented to your public as an unfortunate accident, and we can reach an agreement between ourselves on the Marianas. We stand ready to negotiate a settlement that will serve the needs of your country and of mine. That is the position of my government. With that, the ambassador opened his portfolio and extracted the note which the rules of international behavior required. He rose and handed it to the Secretary of State. If you require my presence, I stand at your service. Good day. He walked back to the door, past the National Security Advisor, who didn't follow the ambassador with his eyes, as the others did. Ryan had said nothing at all. That might have been disturbing in a Japanese, but not in an American, really. He'd simply had nothing to say. Well, he was a European specialist, wasn't he? The door closed, and Ryan waited another few seconds before speaking. Well, that was interesting, Ryan observed, checking his pages of notes. He only told us one thing of real importance. What do you mean? Hansen demanded. Nuclear weapons and the delivery systems. The rest was embroidery, really meant for a different audience. We still don't know what they're really doing. Chapter 25. All the King's Horses. It hadn't made the media yet, but that was about to change. The FBI was already looking for Chuck Searles. They already knew that it wouldn't be easy, and the truth of the matter is that all they could do on the basis of what they had was to question him. The six programmers who'd worked to some greater or lesser extent on the Electra Clerk 2.4.0 program had all been interviewed, and all of them denied knowledge of what they all referred to as the Easter egg, in every case with a mixture of outrage at what had been done and admiration at how. Only three widely separated lines of code, and it had taken all six of them working together 27 hours to find it. Then had come the really bad news. All six of them, plus Searles, had had access to the raw program. They were, after all, the six senior programmers at the firm, and like people with identical security clearances, each could access it whenever he or she wished, up to the very moment that it left the office on the toaster disk. In addition, while there were records of access, each of them also had the ability to fiddle the coding on the master computer and either erase the access time reference or mix it with the others. For that matter, the Easter egg could have been in there for the months it had taken to perfect the program, so finely crafted it was. Finally, one of them admitted quite freely, any of them could have done it. There were no fingerprints on computer programs. Of greater importance for the moment, there was no way of undoing what Electra Clerk 2.4.0 had done. What it had done was sufficiently ghastly that the FBI agents on the case were joking grimly that the advent of sealed thermopane windows in Wall Street office buildings was probably saving thousands of lives. The last identifiable trade had been put up at 12 noon, and beginning at 1 second after 12, all the records were gobbledygook. Literally billions, in fact hundreds of billions of dollars in transactions had disappeared, lost in the computer tape records of the Depository Trust Company. The word had not yet gotten out. The event was still a secret, a tactic first suggested by the senior executives of DTC, and so far approved by both the governors of the Securities and Exchange Commission and the New York Stock Exchange. They'd had to explain the reasons for it to the FBI. In addition to all the money lost in a crash such as had taken place on Friday, there would also have been quite a bit of money made through puts, the name for derivative trades used by many brokers as hedges and a means that allowed profit on a falling market. In addition, every house kept its own records of trades, and therefore, theoretically, it was possible over time to reconstruct everything that had been erased by the Easter egg. But if word of the DTC disaster got out, it was possible that unscrupulous or merely desperate traders would fiddle their own records, It was unlikely in the case of the larger houses, but virtually inevitable in the case of smaller ones, and such manipulation would be nearly impossible to prove, a classic case of one person's word against another's, the worst sort of criminal evidence. Even the biggest and most honorable trading houses had their miscreants, either real or potential. There was just too much money involved, further complicated by the ethical duty of traders to safeguard the money of their clients. For that reason, over 200 agents had visited the offices and homes of the chief executive officers of every trading establishment within a 100-mile radius of New York. It was a feat easier than most had feared, since many of the executives were using their weekend as a frantic work period, and in most cases they cooperated, turning over their own computerized records. It was estimated that 80% of the trades that had taken place after noon Friday were now in the possession of federal authorities. That was the easy part. The hard part, the agents had just learned, would be to analyze them, to connect the trade made by every house with the corresponding trade of every other. As irony would have it, a programmer from Searle's company had, without prompting, sketched out the minimum requirements for the task. A high-end workstation for every company set of records, integrated through yet another powerful mainframe no smaller than a Craig YMP. There was one at CIA and three more at NASA, he told them, along with a very slick custom program. There were thousands of traders and institutions, some of whom had executed millions of transactions. The permutations, he'd said to the two agents who were able to keep up with his fast-forward discourse, were probably on the order of 10^16, maybe 18th. The latter number, he'd had to explain, was 1,000,000 cubed, 1,000,000 × 1,000,000 × 1,000,000. A very large number. Oh, one other thing. They'd better be damn sure that they had the records of every house and every trade, or the whole thing could fall apart. Time required to resolve all the trades? He'd been unwilling to speculate on that, which didn't please the agents who had to return to their office in the Javits Federal Office Building and explain all this to their boss, who refused even to use his office computer to type letters. The term Mission Impossible came to their minds on the short drive back to their offices. And yet it had to be done. It wasn't just a matter of stock trades, after all. Each transaction had also held a monetary value, real money that had changed electronic hands, moving from one account to another, and though all electronic, the complex flow of money had to be accounted for. Until all of the transactions were resolved, the amount of money in the account of every trading house, every institution, every bank, and ultimately every private citizen in America, even those who did not play the market, could not be known. In addition to paralyzing Wall Street, the entire American banking system was now frozen in place, a conclusion that had been reached about the time that Air Force One had touched down at Andrews Air Force Base. Oh, shit, commented the deputy director in charge of the New York Field Division of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. In this, he was more articulate than investigators from other federal agencies who were using his northwest corner office as a conference room. The others mainly just looked at the cheap carpet on the floor and gulped. The situation had to get worse, and it did. One of the DTC employees told the tale to a neighbor, an attorney, who told someone else, a reporter, who made a few phone calls and drafted a story for the New York Times. That flagship paper called the Secretary of the Treasury, who just back from Moscow and not yet briefed on the magnitude of the situation, declined to comment, but forgot to ask the Times to demur. Before he could correct that mistake, the story was set up to run. Secretary of the Treasury Bosley Fiedler practically ran through the tunnel connecting the Treasury building with the White House. Not a man accustomed to strenuous exercise, he was puffing hard when he made it into the Roosevelt Room, just missing the departure of the Japanese ambassador. "What is it, Buzz?" President Durling asked. Fiedler caught his breath and gave a 5-minute summary of what he just learned via teleconference from New York. "We can't let the markets open," he concluded. "I mean, they can't open. Nobody can trade. Nobody knows how much money they have. Nobody knows who owns what. And the banks. Mr. President, we have a major problem here. Nothing even remotely like this has ever happened before."
Buzz, it's just money, right? Arnie Van Dam asked, wondering why it all had to happen in one day, after what had been a rather pleasant few months.
No, it's not just money.
Heads turned because Ryan was the one who answered the question. It's confidence. Buzz here wrote a book about that back when I was working for Merrill Lynch. Perhaps a friendly reference would steady the man down some, he thought.
Thank you, Jack. Fiedler sat down and sipped a glass of water.
Use the 1929 crash as an example. What was really lost? The answer in monetary terms is nothing. A lot of investors lost their shirts, and margin calls made it all worse. But what people don't often grasp is that the money they lost was money already given to others.
I don't understand, Arnie said.
Nobody really does.
It's one of those things that's too simple.
In the market, people expect complexity, and they forget the forest is made up of individual trees. Every investor who lost money first gave his money to another trader, in return for which he received a stock certificate. He traded money for something of value. But that something of value fell, and that's what the crash was. But the first guy, the guy who gave the certificate and got the money before the crash, notionally, he did the smart thing. He didn't lose anything, did he? Therefore, the amount of money out in the economy in 1929 did not change at all.
Money just doesn't evaporate, Arnie, Ryan explained. It goes from one place to another place. It doesn't just go away. The Federal Reserve Bank controls that. It was clear, however, that Van Dam didn't understand.
But then why the hell did the Great Depression happen?
Confidence, Fiedler replied.
A huge number of people really got slammed in 29 because of margin calls. They bought stock while putting up an amount less than the value of the transaction. Today we call that sort of thing leveraging. Then they were unable to cover their exposure when they had to sell off. The banks and other institutions took a huge beating because they had to cover the margins.
You ended up with a lot of little people who were left with nothing but debts they couldn't begin to pay back and banks who were cash short.
Under those circumstances, people stop doing things. They're afraid to risk what they have left. The people who got out in time and still have money, the ones who have not actually been hurt, they see what the rest of the economy is like and do nothing also. They just sit tight because it simply looks scary out there. That's the problem, Arnie.
You see, what makes an economy isn't wealth, but the use of wealth. All the transactions that occur every day, from the kid who cuts your grass for a buck to a major corporate acquisition. If that stops, everything stops. Ryan nodded approval to Fiedler. It was a superb little lecture.
I'm still not sure I get it, the chief of staff said. The president was still listening.
My turn. Ryan shook his head.
Not many people get it. Like Buzz said, it's too simple. You look for activity, not inactivity, as an indication of a trend, but inactivity is the real danger here. If I decide to sit still and do nothing, then my money doesn't circulate. I don't buy things, and the people who make the things I would have bought are out of work. That's a frightening thing to them and to their neighbors. The neighbors get so scared that they hold on to their money. Why spend it when they might need it to eat, when they lose their jobs, right? And on, and on, and on.
We have a real problem here, guys, Jack concluded.
Monday morning, the bankers are going to find out that they don't know what they have either. The banking crisis didn't really start until 1932, well after the stock market came unglued.
Not this time.
How bad? The president asked this question.
I don't know, Fiedler replied. It's never happened before.
I don't know doesn't cut it, Buzz, Durling said.
Would you prefer a lie? The Secretary of the Treasury asked. We need the chairman of the Fed in here. We're facing a lot of problems. The first big one is a liquidity crisis of unprecedented proportions.
Not to mention a shooting war, Ryan pointed out for those who might have forgotten.
Which is the more serious? President Durling asked.
Ryan thought about it for a second.
In terms of real net harm to our country?
We have two submarines sunk, figure about 250 sailors dead, two carriers crippled, they could be fixed.
The Marianas are under new ownership. Those are all bad things, Jack said in a measured voice, thinking as he spoke. But they do not genuinely affect our national security because they do not pertain to the real strength of our country. America is a shared idea. We're people who think in a certain way, who believe that they can do the things they want to do.